Welcome to the KRS Molecular Minute Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Shadi Nabhan. I am the chairman of the KRS Precision Oncology Alliance, our large research collaborative network that collaborates on big data, on biomarker-driven research. We are all hoping to improve the outcomes of all patients affected with cancer. Today, I have the honor and privilege of hosting Dr. Stephen Liu from Georgetown University. Before I introduce Dr. Liu, I want to make sure that for those of you who attended ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting in Chicago this year, on the plenary stage, Dr. Roy Herbst from Yale presented the groundbreaking results of the ADAURA trial. This was the updated results that demonstrated overall survival benefit when adding osimertinib versus placebo for patients with resected lung cancer after finishing and completing adjuvant chemotherapy. And Dr. Liu, Associate Professor of Medicine at Georgetown University and the Director of Thoracic Oncology and the Head of Developmental Therapeutics at Georgetown University, is joining me today on the KRS Molecular Minute Podcast to dissect the ADAURA trial, and he is going to really give you so many nuggets that you are going to listen to this podcast more than once. Trust me on that. I am so pleased to have Dr. Liu with me on today's podcast. And before I air this episode, I have to plug the podcast. Don't forget to find the KRS Molecular Minute Podcast on all podcast outlets. Don't forget to reach out to me at cnabhan@krsls.com with any feedback, opinions, or ideas. Don't forget to refer your friends, colleagues to the show and to write a very brief review about your experience while listening to this podcast. Welcome, Stephen, to the show. I appreciate you taking a few minutes of your busy schedule.
Chadia, a privilege. Thanks for having me.
And just for listeners, by the way, who are really listening to this podcast, I want to make sure I plug your own podcast because you are a podcaster yourself, and I am actually a subscriber. I admit I don't listen to every episode, but I would say probably I'll listen to about 70% of them. So for those of you, you should look up Lung Cancer Considered. Stephen, I've noticed some of the episodes, you actually do them in different language, non-English. Tell us a little about that. How did this come about?
Thanks, Chadi. So this is a podcast I do with the IASLC, the International Association for the Study of Lung Cancer, with my co-host, Dr. Narjust Flores. And, you know, ISLC, this is our professional lung cancer organization. We have our big lung cancer meeting, the World Conference on Lung Cancer, and it is an international organization. Although historically, I think it's shaded a little more towards North America, towards English speaking. And we acknowledge that there are a lot of healthcare providers, a lot of patients that are interested in the topic, but do not speak English, or English isn't their first language. So we started doing podcasts in different languages. We did our first one in Italian with our friend, Dr. Alfredo Adeo. And really, when we did this, I thought, well, this is going to be for people in Italy to make sure they can have their own discussions, to raise awareness there. When we see where the podcast is being downloaded, we see it's being downloaded all over the world. And so it really speaks to just how much of a global community we have. We have episodes in so many different languages, Hebrew, Arabic, Italian, French, Spanish, German, Japanese, Korean, Chinese. The list goes on. Many more to come. We just released a Polish episode and instantly hundreds of downloads. People are waiting for something in their own language. So it is an international organization, and we like to think of it as an international podcast.
I think this is amazing. Honestly, I when I was seeing this and I just noticed the Polish episode, I think it's a great initiative. And so congratulations.
Thank you
for that. Well, we're taping this episode a couple of weeks after ASCO, so I think we've gotten maybe some time to relax a little bit, I believe. But there was a lot of things happening in lung cancer at ASCO, and you guys made it to the plenary session, the biggest stage.
Well, this was the ADAURA trial, and this is another case where this study has been to the plenary session twice. The first one by Dr. Roy Herbst in 2020, that was a virtual iteration. And again, in 2023, same presenter, Dr. Roy Herbst, presenting the data from the ADAURA study. This is, you know, for us, a landmark study. You know, this is a trial for patients with non-small cell lung cancer. Lung cancer is second most common cancer in the U.S. for men and women, by far the most lethal. And increasingly, we were able to detect lung cancer at earlier stages. That's what we want, where we can do curative surgery. But we know that surgery alone doesn't cure most people with lung cancer. We need more treatment. The ADAURA trial looks at something called adjuvant therapy, treatment after definitive or curative surgery. It included patients with fully resected stage 1B to 3A non-small cell lung cancer using the former AJCC version 7 staging system. So in current language, it'd be mostly stage 2 and stage 3 lung cancer, fully resected with an EGFR mutation, specifically a common sensitizing activating EGFR mutation. You know them well, easily detected through a platform like Caris. We're looking for exon 19 deletions and exon 21 L858R point mutations. And so patients fully resected, EGFR mutant, were randomized to receive adjuvant osimertinib, that's a third generation EGFR inhibitor, or placebo for 3 years. Now, in 2020, this study was unblinded to investigators early based on a data safety review showing a profound improvement in disease-free survival, leading to its FDA approval and really establishing a new standard of care. Now, at the time, massive benefit in disease-free survival, 0.17, an unheard-of hazard ratio, quickly became our standard. But there were many who wondered, would this translate to a difference in survival? And that's what we saw at ASCO.
And these patients all received chemotherapy before osimertinib or no?
No, not all. Most who we would normally give chemotherapy to did, but not all. It wasn't required. It was permitted. And there did seem to be some advantage in patients who received chemotherapy. Natural confounder there is I'm likely to give chemotherapy in people that have a little better protoplasm, a little stronger. So that's a possible confounder there. So not required, but most patients with a stage 2-3 lung cancer did receive chemotherapy. In the earlier stages, in the 1B, it's a little controversial as to how much benefit chemotherapy gives, and that's where most of the patients who didn't get chemotherapy fell.
Now, if my memory serves me right, there are patients with stage 3 lung cancer that sometimes receive radiotherapy, maybe more in the neoadjuvant setting. I don't recall properly, but were these patients allowed to get radiotherapy?
So radiation has evolved a little bit since the lung ART trial. Postoperative radiotherapy has largely fallen out of favor, really after it failed to show a survival benefit in that setting. And so radiation, we really wouldn't consider a standard treatment anymore in the resected setting and largely moving out of the neoadjuvant setting as well.
Okay. So you've got two arms. Mm-hmm. One arm, they all had surgery. Mm-hmm. The majority had chemotherapy. And some have osimertinib, the others had placebo. And there was improvement in overall survival. What was the actual improvement? Like what was in years, months? What are we talking about?
What we saw in 2020 was an improvement in disease-free survival. What we saw in 2023 is that did translate to an overall survival benefit. Now, the primary endpoint here was in patients with a resected stage 2 to 3 lung cancer. And the hazard ratio for death, 0.49, so a 51% reduction in the risk of death in absolute numbers. If we look at 5-year survival as sort of our big landmark survival rate in lung cancer, in the placebo arm, 73%, which isn't bad. In the osimertinib arm, 85%, which is quite profound. So an 85% 5-year survival, and this was really seen in every meaningful subset when we break it down by stage, who received chemotherapy, who didn't. By specific mutation, we saw benefit really across the board.
So this is practice changing. Like if you see a patient tomorrow, you are ready to give them osimertinib.
Yes, practice changing. Absolutely, Chadi. Practice changing in a few ways, actually. For some of us, it's practice affirming because we sort of change based on disease-free survival. But I think that this changes practice in a few important ways. Number one, if we have a resected stage 2 to 3 EGFR mutant lung cancer, we know that delivering osimertinib for 3 years after surgery will significantly improve disease-free survival and improve overall survival based on these data. And so this becomes our immediate standard of care. What this also means is we need to start testing people for EGFR at an earlier stage. And now we've been testing for EGFR mutations, you know, for a decade in the stage 4 setting. This tells us that in the earlier stage, it changes practice. Now, the perioperative setting is where we're really seeing a lot of advances in immunotherapy, but patients with an EGFR mutant lung cancer seem to derive much less benefit from immunotherapy. That's a setting where I would rather give osimertinib than immunotherapy. So it really is important to test because it's going to guide adjuvant therapy. Now, the challenge, John, is in the neoadjuvant setting. In the adjuvant setting, we're giving chemotherapy or recovering from surgery. We have time to do this testing. In the neoadjuvant setting, we've seen a lot of early stage immunotherapy trials. CheckMate 816, now FDA approved. The Aegean trial, Keynote 671, also presented at ASCO. These are our studies, regimens, where we're delivering immunotherapy before surgery. Now, in those settings, it will be important for us to exclude patients with an EGFR mutant lung cancer and really direct them towards other strategies. They're not going to get as much benefit from immunotherapy. And if I try to give osimertinib, here, this life-extending adjuvant therapy, if I try to give osimertinib after immunotherapy, it is much more toxic, maybe dangerous. And so not only do we need to know the EGFR status, we need to know it earlier and earlier. You know, we've said this multiple times, Chadi, in private conversations, that really is part of the diagnosis. And so a diagnosis of lung cancer, we need to know that biomarker status, whether there's a mutation like EGFR present.
Okay. Well, I'm going to try just to ask a few questions pertaining to ADAURA, kind of like dissecting ADAURA a little bit, because, you know, as you and I know, social media was buzzing with the information and with the data, but there are always some questions pertaining to the trial. And I think some of these questions are worth responding to or commenting on. The first question is something that's probably more practical, because when you talk to general oncologists, not necessarily someone who just does thoracic day in and day out, they talk about EGFR mutant tumors. What you described earlier, Stephen, is the exon and, you know, 19 and all of that. How important is that? Like, you know, should I care where the mutation is and things like that?
The short answer is yes. And I think what we've seen through the history of oncology and precision medicine is one tenet that's just over and over validating itself, and that's the details matter. When we think of EGFR mutations, the most common sensitizing mutations are deletions in exon 19 and the point mutation in exon 21. But there are other mutations, and they have different consequences. The atypical mutations like G719X, the exon 20 insertions, those mutations may not respond as well to osimertinib. Your therapeutic window is a lot different. There are different agents approved, but different toxicities. And so the calculus is very different for these different mutations. And my prediction, Chadi, is it's only going to get more detailed. That exon 19 deletion, that's not one mutation. That's dozens of different deletions that have what we think is a similar biologic effect. But are these tiny details important? Probably. We're not currently in the position to leverage those differences in a meaningful way, but are there some that need less osimertinib, some that need more osimertinib, some that need chemotherapy more than others, some that need combination therapy? Absolutely. All these details matter. We're only going to get more precise through the use and the understanding of next-gen sequencing and really in-depth bioinformatic analysis.
And it's interesting you mentioned less versus more osimertinib, because that's really a perfect segue into the 3 years that those folks were given. You know, it's fair to say, I think we can both agree that when we think of adjuvant therapy, I don't think of it as 3 years, like in general, right? I mean, I think you pick your tumor and, you know, 6 months of treatment, whatever it is, even the chemotherapy for adjuvant lung cancer was 4 cycles of treatment. So where did this 3 years come from?
Yeah, not a lot of science behind it. We know that earlier studies using 2 years failed to show an OS benefit, suggesting maybe 2 years of an older drug isn't enough. And so 3 years, we definitely see a benefit here. But you make a very good point. This is a shortcoming here. There's no question in my mind that giving adjuvant osimertinib is best practice, that keeping the cancer away is our best strategy for patients' quality of life, quantity of life, well-being overall. That's the strategy. But we got to get a little better. I think of 3 years. Is 3 years enough? Is 3 years too much? There are some people that are already cured after surgery. If we look at the placebo arm at 5 years, they're doing fine. There are some people in that group that are cured with surgery and chemotherapy alone and don't need osimertinib, in which case I'm just adding on toxicity, albeit mild toxicity, but adding tox and adding cost to the patient, to the system. There are others who definitely benefit from the addition of osimertinib. That's that delta. And there are some that after 3 years of being disease-free on osimertinib, when they stop, we see those curves kind of drop. We see they kind of banana a little bit, where, you know, some people were fine up until 3 years. And then once we stop osimertinib, it lets that cancer break through, suggesting maybe for some people, 3 years isn't enough. For some people, you know, do we need to give osimertinib indefinitely? You know, I'll say it's very controversial, but maybe we're just not curing some people. And then giving osimertinib early is keeping that cancer away. What we really need is some sort of marker of minimal residual disease, some sort of biomarker to really tell us who needs this therapy, who doesn't need this therapy, and when, you know, can we stop, if ever. But you know, there are some that wonder, well, if we don't do any osimertinib, wait until relapse and then start osimertinib at relapse, are we going to sort of see the same end result? And would that be a lot less toxicity, both financial and biologic? And my only problem with that is sort of twofold. One, you wait until progression, you roll the dice, because with lung cancer, progression can sometimes be a devastating fatal event. And we have a healthy respect for that. We want to prevent that if we can. Number two, there's some models that suggest giving a targeted agent when there's less disease burden will extend the period of efficacy, really inhibiting resistance. And so if we say someone might recur at 2 years and then take osimertinib, where the median PFS is 1.5 years, that's 2 years, 1.5 years, 3.5 years. But if you start osimertinib at the beginning, would you still get to 3.5 years? Or would that drug, in the context of less disease overall, be effective for 5 years, be effective for 10 years? We don't really know these kinetics yet. This is just scratching the surface, but it's a very important first step.
Two things you said that really, I think they should be investigated. I love your comment about the MRD, because it makes you wonder, right? It makes you wonder, maybe if you're MRD negative, you can avoid using osimertinib, and maybe you can give it to MRD positive folks. I mean, we don't know the answer to that. I presume somebody's going to look at potentially retrospectively, but, you know, I think clearly it's really important comment, and I think it's really critical. So the patients who were randomized to placebo, were they allowed at progression to cross over and receive osimertinib? I think probably that was the most controversial piece I've heard. I did listen to the to Roy's presentation, albeit not live, but I did listen to it, and he did comment on it, but I think he kind of left us a little bit hanging. Like, I didn't feel he addressed it head on. I think he danced around it a little bit because probably he had no control over what people receive upon progression. But tell us about the design of that pertaining to crossover.
So it's a little controversial here, Tati, and you're picking up on a very sensitive point here. Ideally, a study like ADAURA should ask the question, does giving osimertinib immediately after surgery extend survival versus waiting until progression? Really a question of early osimertinib versus late osimertinib. And for that to work, at progression, everyone should receive osimertinib if they're in the placebo arm. And that crossover was not 100%. Osimertinib was provided by the study through a later amendment. But if we look at some of the details, we do see that some people fell off. We don't know the context of everything. But if we look closely, out of, you know, the 184 patients who received a subsequent therapy, 162 received an EGFR TKI. And so that means that there were, you know, 20 some patients that received some treatment other than a TKI. And one can't really imagine a good reason to justify that. Everyone should receive an EGFR TKI. We shouldn't be going to chemotherapy, other things. Now, some of those might be radiation for a single site and so forth. We don't know the exact context in a study like this, but even more worrisome is that TKI wasn't always osimertinib. And so sometimes it was an older generation drug, suggesting it really was a question of access, and that really can skew the numbers a little bit. Now, I don't think that explains the profound benefit shown here, but if you look at the numbers, about 10 to 15% of people who progressed, you know, excluding death, who progressed, did not receive a TKI, and a suboptimal number of those did not receive osimertinib. And so a perfect study would have seen 100% crossover. This was not a perfect study.
Is there such a thing, like in previous studies, where at crossover 100% of folks received this? Because sometimes the design of these trials at the time of progression, at least most trials are designed in a way that at the time of progression, patients are treated at investigator's discretion. Obviously, you should, like to your point, like why would anybody not give a TKI? It's besides me. But often the design is investigator's progression unless it's mandated. I don't know actually what the design was. Was it investigator discretion? Was it?
It was. And so it is never going to be 100%. And sometimes at progression itself really prevents you from getting any treatment. Maybe you're too ill to receive any therapy. Maybe the progression can even be a fatal event. And so that, again, is supporting earlier use of these drugs, not waiting for progression. But if a trial is supplying the medicine at progression, then that should push the crossover number higher. But we see it not just with targeted therapies, we see it with immunotherapy. And, KEYNOTE-024, frontline immunotherapy for PD-L1 high, crossover was permitted, drug was provided. It's never 100%. So, it is more expensive to provide drug at relapse. And I think that some of the criticism, which is, I think, very reasonable criticism, is that more resources in the trial could have been provided to ensure that everyone had access to the drug. But there are different barriers to that, and a lot of it has to do with drug price, regulatory authority barriers, and geographic differences in standards of care. But overall, one would have liked to see more osimertinib use in that placebo arm to really solidify the results of the ADAURA study. I don't think it challenges the validity of the strategy in any way.
Yeah, and I think the hazard ratio is so large, it's very unlikely that anything is going to change the output, the outcome. But yeah, I mean, I do think the better approach would have been that everybody gets access to it. But when you leave it to investigators' discretion, there are a lot of elements that play a role in this. And look, I mean, I was born in Syria where I don't believe they have access to osimertinib as an example. They have access to earlier generation of TKIs. And I think your point is well taken. I think the question would be, would the sponsor would have been able to provide the drug for everybody? And I think, we can go into a big debate on this, which is, the design of the trial did not really mandate them to do it. I think it's really up to them whether they want to provide it or not.
Yeah. Also, what we also remember is we see trials emerge when the results are ready. They're in discussion now, but this is a study that goes back many years, right? The concept is, years old. And so the study launched in 2016. It was sort of a different world back then. And so as standards change, as they shift, the context.
I wanted to comment on that. This is really important. This is almost 7 years to get the trial out. That's a lot of effort, a lot of work. I think we should really be happy with the results for patients with lung cancer. This is, in my view, groundbreaking.
Yeah, I agree. It changes practice, it changes treatment, and it changes our testing strategy.
So the $100 million question is, I mean, you know more than anybody I know about how many mutations are in lung cancer, from the ALK to the ROS to the all of these things. I don't know whether some of these evolve as clones as the disease progress versus they could be present in early stage disease. Obviously, we know that some of them are. Is there a thought, for example, to do the same study for ALK-positive disease and use an ALK inhibitor in the adjuvant setting? That's one question. And then I have another question for you, whether we can omit chemotherapy altogether.
So those are very good questions, and we're asking ourselves those now. So ALK, we know we have very effective ALK inhibitors. That study of adjuvant ALK-targeted agents is already done. That's the ALENA trial. It's a little different design. That's a randomization to alectinib versus chemotherapy, alectinib versus placebo with chemotherapy. So a little bit of a different question, but that question has been asked. That study is completed, and I'm hoping that we see results within the next year. We've also asked that question for RET in one of the Libretto trials, looking at sort of the next generation RET inhibitors. Are those going to provide a similar benefit? And while we don't have any inkling of the data from those studies yet, my prediction is that they will be profoundly positive, I suspect even more than ADAURA. The reason why osimertinib provides such profound benefit is it's well-tolerated drug. You can take it for years. It is highly potent, and it crosses the blood-brain barrier, protecting the brain. Those three features are very true for RET and very true for ALK inhibitors. In fact, more so. So everything that makes osimertinib appealing in this setting, I would say, is even more the case with an ALK inhibitor, even more the case with a RET inhibitor. And so I got to tell you, Chadi, even though it's off-label, if I saw someone today with a resected stage 3A non-small cell lung cancer, we did NGS, we found an ALK fusion, I absolutely would discuss adjuvant ALK inhibition in that setting. I absolutely would discuss adjuvant RET inhibition, acknowledging that we don't yet have that data, but that's what we do, right, Chadi? I mean, we have to sort of make decisions based on imperfect data sets and extrapolate them to the situation at hand. Now, if we look at other mutations, you mentioned there are many, and there are many more to come, but if we look at BRAF, look at MET, look at ROS1, look at NTRK, these are actionable. They're critical in the stage 4 setting. I don't think they check all those boxes in the adjuvant setting. They're not as well tolerated, maybe not as potent in this generation of drugs, not quite as good in the brain for some of those agents. And so that is a setting where I probably would not want to explore targeted therapy. I would still test because we got to look for it. And would this influence your choice of immunotherapy? Because if we're not giving targeted therapy, should we give immunotherapy? Would I give immunotherapy adjuvant PD-L1 inhibition with atezolizumab, for example, to a ROS1 resected lung cancer? And that's a very difficult question because we're unlikely to get any data in that setting. So, targeted therapy, probably not in that setting. Immunotherapy, skeptical there's a strong benefit there, but is it going to be some benefit for some people? I think it's a question we're trying to answer.
Correct me if I'm wrong, please, but pembrolizumab now is approved as adjuvant therapy for regardless of the PD status, right?
Pembrolizumab, regardless of PD-L1, atezo for PD-L1 positive, either one. If we look at ROS1, the PD-L1 in ROS1 is typically very high, but does it mean the same thing? And I don't know, should we offer that therapy knowing that might complicate future targeted therapy treatment if they relapse, or should we withhold that therapy? Would that increase the risk of relapse and create sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy? Very difficult questions we don't know the answer to.
You talked earlier about OC and immunotherapy and all of that. So these patients did not receive in ADAURA any immunotherapy.
No.
In practice, in the real world, the drug, let's say in the U.S., do you think people are going to use IO therapy and then do OC or because it is approved? And B, do you think folks are going to even bother with chemotherapy? And the data is what data is, but then you go to the real world. And how do you think, do we need chemotherapy or?
Yeah, good questions. We will have a little bit of data of some of the perioperative studies like Aegean, KEYNOTE-671. Again, these studies are so old that they were out years ago that we didn't understand all we do now about EGFR and immunotherapy. So there are some patients with EGFR mutations, ALK fusions. We can learn a little bit about those. In the current setting, though, we would not want to explore both therapies for sure. We know from the TATTON trial that giving them together, osimertinib plus a PD-L1 inhibitor, too toxic, unacceptably high rates of pneumonitis. We also know that if we give osimertinib after immunotherapy, because of the long functional half-life of checkpoint inhibitors, it creates also unacceptable toxicity, in some cases fatal. So it really should be one or the other. It should not be both strategies. And, my practice would definitely be for EGFR mutant to explore osimertinib and not even to consider immunotherapy in that setting. But we need a little bit more data there. We should not do both, one or the other. EGFR, I really think targeted therapy is the way to go, not immunotherapy. Is that what we'll see in practice? Hopefully not. We just need to sort of stress that testing is important because you can't make these decisions properly if you don't know the result of the test. Now, the role of chemotherapy, chemotherapy has been our standard for quite a while for resected stage 2-3 non-small cell lung cancer, but we all know the benefit is modest, about a 5% improvement in 5-year survival with fairly toxic agents, the strongest data for cisplatin and vinorelbine. In that setting, is the juice really worth the squeeze? Right. And I think it's questionable. If you look at some of the studies, like the IELTS study, the 10-year difference in survival was even smaller. In fact, it was no longer significant. So we don't really have that durable type of benefit with chemotherapy. Should we exclude chemotherapy for giving EGFR? There's no question that EGFR is going to wash out the DFS difference. There is suggestion that people who receive chemotherapy did survive longer in the ADAURA trial. But again, there's a confounder there because those patients are probably a little bit healthier to start with, maybe a little more support, maybe a little different type of patient that can receive or would agree to chemotherapy. Right now, I think that osimertinib probably is the more important aspect of treatment. Right. So if someone won't tolerate chemotherapy, has some relative contraindications, I have no qualms about omitting it, but if they're able to, it would still be my practice to offer offer chemotherapy in that setting. I would still consider it standard of care.
I have a research idea for you, for one of your fellows. I think over the next year or so, you're going to see some folks getting OC alone, some folks getting OC and chemotherapy. That's a good retrospective analysis, despite its caveats, to see actually if there's any difference in outcomes. And I don't mean to be an author, don't worry. Stephen, anything else pertaining to Adora you think relevant to our listeners that you'd like to share with them? This was really amazing.
It's a simultaneous publication, New England Journal of Medicine. Take a look at that. Take a look at the supplemental data. A lot of good information there. But across the bar, osimertinib in the adjuvant setting, improving outcomes. There is toxicity, and low-grade toxicity in the curative setting is probably a little more important or a little more noticeable. You know, if you have someone with a stage 4 lung cancer, when you give osimertinib to an EGFR mutant lung cancer, they feel better. And so the drug is sort of has this positive light. Someone whose cancer is gone is not having symptoms from their cancer. You can't make them feel better with osimertinib. You know, make them feel worse. And so the toxicity might be a little more noticeable. It's important to watch out for mucositis, diarrhea, rash, to really be aggressive in controlling those. But overall, resounding benefit with the use of osimertinib in the adjuvant setting, our new standard, and stay tuned to see how this continues to shape the field.
Dr. Stephen Liu, thank you so much for visiting on the Caris Molecular Minute podcast, and thanks for everything you're doing on behalf of the patients with lung cancer. Thank you.
Anytime. Thanks, Josh.
Folks, thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you joining the Caris Molecular Minute podcast on this special edition with the Adora trial dissected, visiting with Dr. Stephen Liu from Georgetown University. Thank you for listening. This is Dr. Shadi Nabhan, and until next time, take care.